I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Sola El-Waily has been many things in her career. She was the pastry chef of one of my favorite restaurants in my neighborhood, which I know doesn't matter a whole lot to a whole lot of people, but it's where I learned that she was brilliant and maybe a little bit devious. But after leaving the restaurant world, she became a writer, recipe developer, and eventually a bona fide cooking video superstar at Serious Eats, Bon Appetit, in the Babish culinary universe, and now at the New York Times. She makes ingenious recipes, indulges in her deep sense of nerdiness by cooking ancient historical dishes. She teaches her audience how to take pro techniques and make them feel completely comfortable at home. And I knew people loved her work, but I knew it was really serious when I saw one of her fans once post, quote, "I would lay down my life for Sola." And now Sola is a best-selling cookbook author with a book called Start Here that I can assure you was engineered for maximum impact. At 5 pounds, 600 plus pages, and step-by-step photos for every recipe, it's like a culinary school on your shelf. And we are spending the whole hour with her this week, talking about that book, taking your questions, and more. Hey, Sola, it's great to see you.
Hey, good to see you too.
You know, so many people know you from your cooking videos, and I so love how you've done so many different types of videos, and they really kind of showcase your personality, your life, you know, from your love of teaching people to cook. You know, I love the ones where you work with your husband, Ham, and, you know, certainly showing off your deep nerdiness for history and just like nerdiness more generally. But, you know, it occurred to me that I have followed your work for so long and we've known each other for a little while, but I don't actually know how you got into food and cooking. So how'd that happen?
Well, we're going to go back. We're going to take it back. Well, I grew up in a house with really good food. So that was the beginning. My mom is a very good cook. And I spent a lot of time with her in the kitchen, not just because I liked cooking, but also because it was the one place where we really got along. Because I didn't totally always get along with my family. Because they're very conservative, but the one place where we could put everything aside and click was in the kitchen. So that was really the start. I guess it's when I realized that you can really connect with anybody over food. But I never thought it was going to be a career. Not
right.
even
it was like an emotional
a little bit.
Connection you had, and you like recognized.
Yeah,
that,
I liked cooking, and like I fantasized about having a restaurant in the same way you fantasize about being in a band. Like, you don't really think you're gonna ever get a Grammy, you just pretend to receive one in the bathroom.
Yeah, sure. Thank you everyone. Oh my god, I couldn't have done it without you, my amazing producers,
and god.
Yeah, thank god.
I especially because my family's so conservative, I didn't think food was going to be a career. But I went to school for economics. I really hated it. And then I dropped out. I did eventually go back. I have to say that on the record. So my aunts and uncles know.
No doubt.
You know, family who's listening know. But yeah, I really, really hated anything besides food. Like, it's the only thing that I did that I actually wasn't miserable and that I felt like I could be good at. So I did work in like assorted food related jobs while I was in school, you know, like some chain restaurants, coffee shops, you know, stuff like that. Things just to get through school.
Sure.
But I really wanted to get into like fine dining. I think after I graduated, I was like super lost, really depressed. I graduated in 2008. So it was like not the best time.
Yeah.
Not the best time. So I just like backed back into like all the restaurant jobs. I was working at a pub and I really liked the restaurant environment, which a lot of people hate, but it just really worked for me.
I feel you on that. I mean, like I had a similar story in the sense of like I had an emotional connection to food from an early age, but never thought it could be a career, never thought it would be, you know, my professional path. But same thing, actually, while I was in college, I started working at restaurants and in like a catering service just to, exactly the same thing. So I can pay my rent. But did love the environment and love the camaraderie. And yes, I think we all know it can be super problematic. It can be, like the difference between something being harsh and tough and you feel great with your team because you pulled it through together and an environment that feels abusive or feels, like the people are being taken advantage of, that's a continuum, right? So it really just depends on the place or even the day where your work life fell in that matter. But like, yeah, I had a similar experience to you, which is like, it was really hard. And there are days when I'm like, I can't do this anymore. And there are so many days where I'm like, oh my God, I love this.
But I knew I wanted to go beyond like the Cheesecake Factory
Yeah, sure.
or go beyond getting fired from the Cheesecake Factory. So I really wanted to get into fine dining because I like grew up watching that PBS show, Great Chefs of
Oh
America. No, Great
yeah.
Chefs
Just
of the
great, yeah,
World.
great chefs, yeah.
And I really wanted to be one of those chefs with a paper hat making souffles and stuff. I like fantasize about having a French restaurant. So I wanted to get into fine dining. I read about this story that Grant Achatz got his job at the French Laundry by basically harassing Thomas Keller.
Yeah. So Grant is the
So
chef owner of Alinea, which is, one of the great restaurants of the world, and Thomas Keller at the French Laundry. Yeah, totally.
yeah, so I that was my initial tactic.
I'm just gonna go harass people.
I actually like I had like a stack of resumes and I walked up and down Ventura Boulevard because I thought that was a fancy restaurant at the time. I'm from the Valley. I didn't know, I grew up going Outback Steakhouse. I thought that was fine dining, so I didn't realize that Ventura Boulevard restaurants weren't fine dining, but in my mind at the time they were. So I walked up and down Ventura Boulevard harassing all the chefs while they're trying to get ready for service, trying to get a job. Did not really work. I even asked, I was like, please just let me wash some dishes for free. It totally, that did not click for me. So I ended up going to culinary school.
Okay.
Felt like a good stepping stone into fine dining, which it was. I firmly don't recommend culinary school to anybody. But it's tough because trying to get into a lot of these spaces, having something like that on your resume really does help.
Right.
But most chefs don't do background checks, so you should probably just lie. It's too much debt. It's so much debt. Like
This is going on the air.
it's so much debt. Like I want to save the young people, from. You're going to get so much debt from these schools and then just die in it because you make $8 an hour working in a restaurant.
There is a real disconnect. I think this we could have a whole conversation just about this for sure. But anyway, I definitely want to talk to you about your book because your book. I don't know if you were intending the anti-culinary school thing to be like, you could just buy my book because my book is
No,
basically a culinary school between two covers.
My book was inspired by how much I hated culinary school. Nobody go to culinary school. Don't get into debt. Definitely don't take out a loan. You're going to be like, oh, it's just $20,000, and then before you know it, you're buried,
For
buried
$40,
alive.
you could have Sola's entire culinary school in your brain.
Boom. Wow, such a great deal.
Yeah, okay. I totally want to get to that. But we also have a lot of callers who really want to talk to you. So we have
Okay, cool.
Eric on the line, and let's check in
Is
with
this
Eric first.
live?
This is live.
Whoa.
He's a real human.
Hello.
Hey, Eric.
Hi.
Hi, Eric.
Thanks for the call.
Well, I can get prize-winning black rabbits from a local farmer here in Broad Run, Virginia,
Oh, wow.
with the carcasses weighing about 5 pounds.
Oh, wow, big ones.
So I tried using Elmer Fudd's Hasenpfeffer recipe, but it was pretty tough. And so, what's the best way to cook rabbit, especially deboning the ribs and spine, but still being able to get the meat?
Oh, wow. Okay. So, Sola, I don't recall you having a rabbit chapter in the book, but being a lover of fine dining, have you cooked with rabbit before?
I have. And I think of rabbit as just like really difficult chicken. Like, first, get really good at chicken. And then a lot of the anatomy is the same. A rabbit's body is just longer, but you break it down in a similar way. You'll find the joints in the same way. And it has a lot of the same issues that you have when you're cooking chicken, but exaggerated. So, you know, in a chicken, the breast meat is very lean and the dark meat is a little bit tougher. But that's like that contrast is like leveled up in a rabbit. So white meat on a rabbit gets really dry really fast. And while the leg meat can be more tough because rabbits are running around, they get a lot of...
There's a lot of power in those muscles,
Yeah, they live a life. So I think the best way to cook a rabbit is to break it down, separate it. I don't like to cook it whole because I do find that it's harder to get like really good out of both the light and the dark meat. So I would break it down. I recommend being really delicate with the loin. I like to keep the bones in while cooking because I feel like it just kind of prevents it from overcooking. And for that, go for like something more gentle, like a sear. Maybe not grill, you know, focus on like stovetop sear butter based situation just until you get to know how to cook that loin better. And then the legs, I would definitely brace. Give it some time to get really nice and tender. And always dry brine. Everything should always be dry brined, especially rabbit, because it does have these like extra fun challenges.
Oh, interesting. So do you mean just like salt it as if you were seasoning it to cook, but then let it hang out in the fridge overnight before you actually cook it?
Yeah. Cover it in a nice layer of salt, pop it on a rack, throw it in the fridge, and then that salt's going to be drawn out from the moisture in the meat, form a concentrated brine on the surface where it gets sucked back in, seasons the meat, tenderizes the muscles, breaks down the fat. It's going to just like make it a little bit more foolproof. Also, whenever I'm not sure what to do with something that kind of reminds me of chicken, just fry it.
There's really no, I mean, okay, people are going to get on my case about this. There is such a thing as bad fried chicken, but like I've never seen a chicken, like a fried chicken so bad that wasn't like actually like set on fire or burned that I wasn't like, I was sad to eat that. You know? So I guess that's a fair approach. But I would say this about the loin, the white meat. I think it is very chickeny for sure, but I don't think it's exactly the same as chicken. So if you're getting these wonderful rabbits and you really want to highlight the fact that you're eating rabbit and not chicken, I would think just in general, I would do sort of more mild mannered accompaniments and cooking techniques, right? Like Sola, you said, dry brine the breast or the loin. And then you can like sear it and then like baste it with butter. So cook it somewhat gently and really just kind of enjoy the flavor of the rabbit that way, to my mind. Like I would just enjoy it for what it is. And like light vegetables, spring vegetables would be super nice. But the legs, I do like a really nice braised rabbit leg with like mushrooms, bacon, some stock, onions, and you know, braise them to a tender and serve that with pasta, like fresh pasta, I think is super nice.
Making me hungry now. Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Eric. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Sola El Whaley, author of Start Here. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending time today with one of the modern stars of the culinary world, Sola El Whaley. Let's get back to it with her. You were a pastry chef at first, weren't you?
No, I was savory.
Oh, okay.
But then how did you turn into pastry? Because that's just what happened back then. It feels like I was in the kitchen such a long time ago because it has changed so much in the last like 15 years. But when I started, there was a lot of times where I was the only girl. So they would just be like, oh, just go make a cake. You can do that, right? Which, you know, to their surprise, I couldn't at the time. I remember I was externing at Del Posto. I was on the Asagi line, which is like their... Yeah, it's a fancy Italian place that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Because of controversy. Yeah. But... you guys can look it up. It's fun. No, I was working on like the Asaji line, which is where you make all these little snacks. Like we made like little what's arancini
Oh yeah, like
situation.
little fried rice balls and stuff.
Yeah, and some chickpea things. I barely remember, but they were short on pastry, so they just assumed because I was a girl that I knew how to make choux. And
Which
then they
like
just pâte à choux. And I had never made
You're
it
a girl,
before, and
make
they
some
were
pate
like,
choux. Oh my
yeah,
God.
I had didn't even know what it was. They gave me this recipe, and they're like, okay, go make 4,000 pâte à choux in a tilt skillet, which I had not done before. So I just wasted like 80 eggs, you know? So you shouldn't assume. You should assume nobody knows how to do anything. But yeah, so that's really how I got into pastry. I just kept getting thrown at it, and I did like it very much. So I rolled with it. You know, sometimes you just roll with the punches, and it ended up being really fun. And I think it kind of gave me a leg up because now I feel comfortable with both. And did you know the book is half pastry?
I did know that.
Whoa,
I did know
crazy.
that. 300
Like my
pages of
life.
pastry.
Yeah.
So I know you just mentioned, working on a tilt skillet, which is, a kiddie pool sized thing that you cook in a commercial environment. But you don't use those anymore. And actually, I think that brings us to our next caller.
Hello.
Hey, May, where are you calling from?
Hey, I'm calling from Port Angeles, Washington.
Hi, May.
Oh, right on. What would you like to talk about?
Yeah, so I have a quick question. I'm just wondering what appliances or kitchen tools do you both consider must-haves for us amateur chefs out here?
Okay.
Well,
Solo.
I think when you're starting out, you could get away without having anything that you need to plug in. You can. I think in the beginning, all you really need is I recommend a solid cast iron skillet, and like get to know how to season it. It's very affordable, like $20. You can get a 10-inch cast iron skillet and pretty much cook anything in it, as well as a Dutch oven, which if you're buying a new Dutch oven, it is very expensive. So I've actually never bought a new Dutch oven. It's very easy to find used Dutch ovens at like thrift stores, or even you could get a new Dutch oven at like a Ross or Marshall's that's like the last season's color,
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's super
and it's
smart.
like so affordable. So don't be intimidated by like the $300 Dutch ovens. It doesn't need to be that way. And a cutting board and a knife. And I believe that is all you need, and you can cook most things with like cutting board, knife, Dutch oven, skillet. Oh, of course, some spoons. But you don't need to worry about appliances. Like, you could get away without a blender or a KitchenAid. I don't even own a rice cooker. It'll be okay.
Fair enough.
My only personal exception to that is I can't live without my rice cooker. I can cook rice on the stove, I can cook rice in the oven, but I just feel like I'm doing something wrong to my ancestors if I don't have a rice cooker. So that's my own only beef with that.
Your
I do agree though.
ancestors did not have a rice cooker, Francis.
I don't know what you're talking about. We have been using rice cookers in China
What, 10,000 years
since
ago?
10,000 BC, before white people had electricity, we figured out rice cookers. You just can't convince me otherwise. But I totally agree. I mean, actually, I feel bad now because now I pigeonholed myself as like, hello, I'm Chinese. I should talk about a wok. And like, I do have a wok, but actually, I rarely use my wok because I cook everything in a cast iron skillet. And saucepans. I do really love my saucepans. For saucepans, like I love my li I bought this thing on sale once in a department store. I was in my 20, I was like maybe 20, so I've had this thing for many more than 20 years. And it was a little one quart like all clad saucepan. I'd never owned anything all clad, and I was like, oh my God, I can buy an all clad thing, and it was only $30 on sale. Like, what do you do with a one quart saucepan? I love that saucepan. I use it almost daily. Anything I want to cook for myself, I can pretty much cook in a one quart saucepan. It's just, I made rice for myself
Actually,
in my one quart saucepan. Like
that's amazing.
a small saucepan is so useful,
a
like
small
boiling
saucepan.
eggs,
Yeah.
making rice not in a rice cooker.
Yeah. I did it. I did do it the other day. Well, you know, because I was making basmati rice. And my friend Kushbu was like, you don't use a rice cooker for basmati rice. Now you're offending my ancestors. I'm like, okay, fair. So I did make I did make the basmati rice in the 1 quart saucepan. What do you have that you're like, is this the right thing? Is this the wrong thing? Or what do you feel like you're missing?
I think right now what I'm missing, I feel like I'm missing a really good, like, knife set. I have a saucepan. I have the cast iron skillet. That's a little new for me. So I'm still figuring out, like, how to season it and would love any tips or tricks there. But, yeah, I think what I'm missing is just a really good knife. Mm-hmm. If y'all have any recommendations.
Well, I don't think you need a full set, because I feel like with those sets, you usually don't end up using most of the knives. I think go for a chef's knife, a serrated, and a paring or a petty, and you could pretty much do everything. I prefer a petty knife, which is like 6 to 8 inches long, versus a paring, which is more like 4 inches, because you can kind of use it for butchering fish, meat. It can do a lot. And then for the chef's knife, I believe a chef's knife is whatever you feel comfortable cutting with. So it doesn't have to be, you know, the German,
you know, like wrapped up in a bag, very fancy.
No. Yeah. Start simple. And I think you should aim for whatever knife you feel comfortable sharpening, because all knives go dull, no matter what kind of knife you get, it will get dull. So you want to focus on something you can comfortably sharpen.
That's so helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm a little bit disappointed sometimes, because like I'm not like a very materialistic person, but I have a little bit of like, I have a very small like collector's kind of like side to me. Like, I'd love to get more of these, and wouldn't it be nice to get something nice and new? And and you know, I'm like, oh, I cook, so I should buy kitchens. I'm like, you know, every time I buy a new knife, I'm like, I don't need that. I buy a new pan. I don't need that. You know, I don't use it. I use my 1 quart saucepan. I use a 5 quart saucepan. I use a Dutch oven. I use a cast iron skillet. I use the 3 knives you mentioned. And like, that's kind of all I ever use ever.
I think we're getting into a deeper conversation. What hole are you trying to fill with all this stuff? I'm personally,
that's a really good question.
I'm pretty anti-stuff. Which is annoying for some people.
Look, I appreciate you saying that. I have also seen what your kitchen looks like, so you cannot come at me with that. You have an entire restaurant speed rack in your New York City apartment.
Like, I didn't buy most of it.
What hole are you filling by pretending to be someone you're not? How about that?
I don't know.
Okay, mate, we're going to let you go while Sol and I fight it out and pull our therapist into this.
Cool. So,
but thank you so much for the call.
No, thank you both so much. Sol, I loved you in the big brunch. Have a good one.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Thank you. We have another caller. Let's go right to her, and hopefully this won't get into our deep-seated emotional issues. Hey, Melanie.
Hello.
Hey, Melanie.
Hi, Melanie. Thanks for the call. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I've been wondering why my last attempt at making pavlova was unfortunately such a disappointment. I knew about not attempting to make egg white meringue type dishes on a cloudy, overcast day. And even though this was a bright, sunny, beautiful spring day, the pavlova came out sticky and real chewy instead of the wonderful dry, crunchy way that it does come out when it's done right, if it comes out right. And so I didn't know if it was the new gas oven that I just bought or if that had anything to do with it, if you had any advice on what might be the issue there.
That's an interesting question. Well, Melanie, I have to say, first of all, I love a pavlova. So typically a pavlova is a baked meringue, a very light meringue with some, often a fruit sort of sauce or a compote, or sometimes there's like a lemon curd or something, and usually some cream. And so you have this like really nice meringue with that yummy, tasty thing it's on top of. I have to say, I love a chewy pavlova. And in fact, I much prefer a chewy pavlova over a crispy dry one. However, you want a crispy dry one and Sola can get you there. So Sola, what's the problem?
Okay, so tell me about your pavlova recipe. What kind of sugar was in it, and did it contain any starch?
Well, I believe it was powdered sugar, confectioner's sugar, that does have some cornstarch in it.
Okay, cool. Mm. That's my preferred sugar for pavlova, so I don't think it was the recipe. There's two things that could have happened. The first is if you under whip it, so if you don't whip the sugar and eggs till stiff peak, it won't like really bake up crisp like that. So if it was more of like a soft peak when you baked it, you might end up with something more chewy. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, even if it was a clear day, it could have been humid. Really, the enemy of pavlovas and anything with that much high concentration of sugar is humidity. So perhaps it was humid that day, even though it was clear out. Those are the two main things, the under whipping and the humidity. The other thing could be, because you said it was a new oven, maybe the air circulation wasn't the same as your old one. So I always, after I bake it, I leave the door cracked open with a wooden spoon, and that kind of lets some of the moisture out. And actually, I have an old oven that doesn't really let the air circulate very well. So I pop open my oven a couple times while I'm baking just to make sure all the moisture can have somewhere to go during the baking process. I don't know if that helps.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. That's great suggestions.
So actually, if you wanted to go for a crisp meringue versus a sort of chewier, sticky meringue or vice versa, is it like a bake time thing? Is it you actively whisk less if you want the chewy version? Like, is it in the recipe? Would you see it in the recipe that you're like, oh, this will obviously lead to one versus the other? Or
I don't know if you can tell from the recipe. I think a perfect pavlova for me is where the outside is crispy and the inside is like a marshmallow, kind of pillowy and soft.
Right.
And what distinguishes a pavlova from just a regular meringue is there's always a little bit of starch, which helps you get that like pillowy inside. So I like making pavlovas with powdered sugar because you already get that starch in there. Instead of some recipes, you make your meringue with granulated sugar and then you fold in the starch, which is kind of hard to do. So you might end up with like pockets of cornstarch in there. So that starch will help you get that like pillowy texture. But if you intentionally want like a chewy meringue,
Like, yeah, you're right. With like a crisp crust, like a chewy in the inside.
I feel like it's about maybe just baking it less, perhaps. When I'm going for like that crisp outside, pillowy inside, I bake it until it's set enough that you can peel it off the paper. Like, you'll be able to like get your spatula underneath the meringue and like it should easily peel off. So you know that the outer shell of the meringue is set, but it won't be totally dry. It'll feel a little bit soft. And then when you let it sit out at room temperature, it'll kind of stiffen up a bit more. So I think it's a little bit about bake time and a little bit about whipping. And it's one of those things where it's like kind of just getting all those details ironed out, which is unfortunately what baking's all about, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Melanie.
Yeah, thank you. I'm wondering now, after hearing all this, maybe it's because of where I live now in Southern Virginia, where the humidity is high no matter what, it seems like, whether it's a bright sunny day or not. So that may be the culprit of the whole thing. So
yes, Virginia, it's tough.
I'm not going to stop trying to make it, though. It's so yummy and fresh fruit. So thank you again for your help. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So actually, are we just like out of luck if you live in a humid environment? Can you just not make this dish?
I feel like yes.
Sad but
not
true.
Not everything's
fact.
Meant for everyone. It's fine.
Yeah. Sorry. In the winter, is it less humid, like in December?
No, surprisingly not. I I mean, I'm just getting that from the, you know, the internet weather, but when I see humidity 86% and the sun is out, I'm curious as to, you know, what is it, but they obviously know how to measure it, so.
Wait, I have a workaround for you. Okay. You know the fully dry crisp meringues that you can buy in the box?
Yeah.
Yeah, those try making like a eat and mess with those. That's like where you take those meringues and you crush them up and you layer it with fruit and whipped cream. And then some of the meringue will start to melt and maybe kind of give you that like pillowy vibe. But because I think it'll be a little bit tough in Virginia to make pavlova unless you have like a dehydrator. But don't go buying a dehydrator. Just try the store-bought meringues.
Yeah. Okay.
We literally told the last caller, you don't have to buy anything but a cast iron pan. It's like, now we're like, oh, go get a dehydrator. Hmm. Actually, don't really do that.
Okay. Well, thanks again.
All right, Melanie. Well, thank you so much for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
I didn't feel like you were doing this, but I felt a little bit shamed by my preference in pavlova. But that's okay. I love a pavlova. I think a pavlova is a wonderful dessert. It's one of the greatest in the world. But I really especially like it when it's just a little chewy and sticky in the middle.
It's great. Good. Make it in the summer. It'll be chewy for you.
Yeah, I'm just going to go buy one. I'm not going to make it. That's why we need pastry chefs. Long live the pastry chef. We're spending the hour with one of America's favorite cooking video stars and author of the cookbook, Start Here, Sola El Whaley. More coming up. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We've got our good friend and cooking video star, Sola El Whaley, on today. Let's get back to it with her. We have another caller. This is Angela. Hey, Angela, how are you?
Hi, Francis. I'm doing really well. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. You're here with Sola, and what would you like to talk about?
Well, I would like to say thank you. You are both on my imaginary best friend list, so it's so amazing to be able to talk to you. And I have a question about ice cream. And my question is, I've been substitute teaching at a low-income elementary school, and I heard this really interesting conversation. So I pulled a Francis Lamb and just asked a question and listened instead of asking the children to go back to their tables. They were saying, one of them mm-hmm. said he had a freezer under his bed. This is a 7-year-old. And the freezer was full uh-huh. of ice cream of all the flavors in the world. And he was allowed to eat any of them that he wanted to. And I kind of waited to see what the little girl would do, if she'd call him a liar or what, you know, what was going to happen. And she leaned in with her eyes wide mm-hmm. and said, me too. You know, and I thought, that's amazing that she just joined mm-hmm. his fantasy and, you know. And so I thought, I do have an ice cream maker.
That's awesome.
I wonder, it's a really food insecure school. What would be a flavor that they haven't tasted that I could make that, you know, I could take it into the class and they could taste something really interesting?
This is, okay, we might be on real best friends list soon because this is an amazing question. And I love that you want to do this. It is so amazing.
Thanks.
But, okay, what would be a really interesting, well, you, okay, so an interesting flavor, but you want to be like something that wouldn't be like so off the wall. They're just like, why?
Exactly. Yes.
But cool and delicious. And Sola, what you got?
I mean, so there's this YouTube series where they would ask kids to draw a food and then a chef would try and make it, and sometimes they would draw things like, I want a dragon cake with gummy bear eyes, and maybe they can help you brainstorm. Include some audience participation. But my favorite flavor of ice cream is actually vanilla.
Thanks for the help, Sola.
Yeah.
But you have like a vanilla hack. I mean, maybe they would love that too because they're seven. So that would be sort of a gentle flavor.
Mm. Well, I think when you make vanilla with like a really good vanilla bean, I like to get vanilla beans online because they tend to be fresher from somewhere like Regalis or Halea Vanilla. When you buy it online, it's like really fresh and really sticky and super aromatic. And it's like completely different from the one you get it in the store in like the little jars. I think it's the greatest smell in the world.
It is incredible.
And you don't actually need very much. You can make a quart of vanilla with like half a bean.
Ooh.
And I think it could be cool to like, I don't know, let them smell the pods, you know, do a little teaser.
Okay, love that. They would love that.
Let them smell the pods before you make the ice cream. I always recommend, like, I'll make my base with the seeds and the pod, and then I, like, let it steep overnight. So it gets, like, really intense. And I feel like when you let vanilla, like, really steep, and I prefer to do, when I'm making a vanilla and I really want to taste the vanilla, I do an eggless base. So it's just milk, cream, a little bit of corn syrup, sugar, and milk powder. And I like doing that like eggless base so nothing gets in the way of the vanilla flavor. It's just like the vanilla and the milk and the cream. And then let it steep overnight, maybe even like two nights. And then that aroma really like permeates. And I feel like it tastes like orchids and marshmallows. To me, it's like really the best flavor. Most vanilla ice creams out there are Madagascar vanilla, but you could try like Tahitian vanilla or Mexican vanilla. And I know it's just vanilla, and vanilla gets like a bad rap, but I really do love it. And it'll be unlike any vanilla ice cream they could buy.
I love that. And I love that you added steep overnight too, because that's the kind of, you know, things that are left out of cookbooks. And like Frances said something just offhand about peeling the stems of broccoli. And that's the kind of thing that a lot of people don't write down. So thank you for the, you know, steep overnight tip.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. And actually, I love Sola's, I mean, you'll need an actual recipe, but her idea of using an eggless base,
mm-hmm.
where that does include corn syrup and milk powder, those are two kind of magic ingredients that I would not skip, because the corn syrup, you know, also another thing that gets a bad rap, you're not using it like, you know, an industrial food processor does. Like, don't worry about 2 tablespoons of corn syrup in your homemade ice cream. That really, really helps the texture of the ice cream. And the milk powder, A, adds a little more milk flavor, but the protein in the milk powder also helps to keep your ice cream texture like really super smooth and creamy. And I think it also like keeps it so you can like keep it longer in the freezer, right? Like, it sort of stabilizes the texture so it doesn't want to get sort of icy and grainy in the freezer as easily. But how much ice cream are you going to make, Angela?
The teachers have about 24 students in the class, so mm-hmm. I could easily, you know, make a couple gallons and then bring in little ice cream cones and do it in class. And I love the idea of sharing the smell of the pods with them. So, and I love the idea of corn syrup too, because we are in corn country, and I feel like the corn syrup could sort of hold hands with the unfamiliar and introduce the kids in that way, something they know and something they don't know.
Oh, that's cool. Hey, you know, okay, so you're making a lot of ice cream. If you're like a home ice cream maker, which probably makes like a quart at a time.
Right.
If you're making several gallons, so you're making ice cream for like a bunch of weekends, stashing it in your freezer. I would say corn ice cream. I've never met anyone who doesn't love sweet corn ice cream.
I've never heard of this.
But so many people, the first time they have it, like, it blows their mind that you can make, literally make ice cream that tastes like corn. So let go. Because I can't think of a recipe off the top of my head.
Oh, I love corn ice cream. Corn ice cream is very good. So I like to both make a puree with the fresh corn. This would probably be better in the summer when the corn is sweet.
But could it work with like frozen corn? Like, because frozen corn is often still pretty sweet.
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, I tried. Well, I tried,
because
Angela.
Because when you blitz up the corn, the frozen corn has like a little grittiness. But you want to shave off the kernels, and you're going to put the kernels and the cobs in there, cook it all together. Also, go eggless here. And then once you've got, like, give it that overnight steep again. Once you've gotten all your flavor from your cobs, you want to take them out and, like, really use your hands to squeeze every bit of ice cream base off of it. And then you're going to puree it to blitz up the corn, like, kernels, and pass that through a fine mesh strainer. And it's very tasty. And I feel like with corn ice cream, you need a little extra salt. Really brings out that corn flavor. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be kind of like a little salty, savory corn ice cream situation.
I've never heard of anything like this.
Oh, that'll be really good in corn country.
It'll be, no one on this planet does not fall in love with sweet corn ice cream the first time they taste it. It's just magic.
Wow. Okay. Why would you add the cob though? What does the cob do for it?
Oh, there's just a lot of flavor in the cob. Like, you don't want to let it go to waste.
Yeah.
Okay.
Something I do sort of maniacally during summer is when I buy fresh corn and I use the corn, I store all the cobs. Like, I'll just, like, wrap it in plastic wrap. If I had three, you know, cobs of corn that night, I'll just take the cobs, wrap them in plastic wrap, and then one day my wife will open the freezer and be like, why did you take a quarter of the freezer in corn cobs? Please get rid of these. And so I take them all out and I boil them in water. And the corn stock is terrific. I use it in place of vegetable stock, in place of chicken stock. It's
wow.
Just, it has just like such a nice, mellow corn flavor. It's great.
That's amazing. I've never heard of anyone doing that around here.
Yeah, that's how you know we're fancy, because we use all the garbage that people throw out.
Oh, I love that.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Angela. And I really hope you make really wonderful ice cream and the kids love the vanilla, the experience of all the vanilla, or if you want to wait till the summer and make them corn ice cream. I just love that you're doing that. That's really wonderful.
Okay, I'll send you a picture.
Please do.
Thank you.
Yeah,
good luck.
Thank you so much. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Oh my God, I love that. Okay, so I want to get back to you, Sola. Now that we've done several pastry calls in a row, and you were a pastry chef, and half your book is pastry, but I don't want to focus only on that because, like you said, women so often get typecast as pastry chefs in the restaurant world. But there's something that was really interesting about the intro to your book and how you talked about being a particular kind of learner. And you're not really one to memorize facts or memorize the steps, you know, like that's not really your strength. But for you, when you learn about the why, you're like, tell me why this is and then I'll get it. And I kind of feel like pastry and baking is like sort of famously or stereotypically this like world where like it's all about precise measurements and precise techniques. And you got to know exactly one thing, next thing, third thing. And that's the only way to do it. But talk to me about your approach to writing your book, both the pastry side and the savory side, and how much you wanted to focus on the why rather than the what do I do next?
Well, I guess the first thing I did was figure out what I thought the core techniques I wanted to focus on would be. So each chapter is a technique. And that just like narrowing that down took forever because I really wanted it to be what was essential to the home cook. So there's a lot that's left out because like there's no, I initially had a frying chapter, but like, you don't need to fry. Yeah, there was a lamination chapter.
What do you mean
chapter,
I don't need to fry?
You can eat really well without deep frying ever, you know? So once I figured that out.
Please continue.
then it was just like, then I guess my primary focus was really how to teach people those techniques through the text and through the recipes. So every recipe is meant to really teach you more about the technique. So there are dishes in there that are like good weeknight dinners, of course, but it's really a teaching book. So every recipe is meant to teach. And then the text as well, I really wanted to break down every single one of these techniques, like as much as I possibly could, like the science, the hows, the equipment, because I really want you to get it. Like, I really want you to leave the book, like after the searing chapter, I want you to know everything about how to sear so that anytime you find a recipe where there's searing, you like get it. You're not like blindly just following a step to like pat your meat dry. You understand why. You know that like, oh, I need dry meat to make browning happen because the enemy of brown is wet. you know? So I really wanted to explain all the whys, because I think it just makes it easier to know what you're doing, whether you're following a recipe or not.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But I also love, okay, so a lot of, you know, it's not the first book to want to teach basic cooking techniques in a sort of systematic way, but a lot of times I do find when folks write those books, like, they feel like, well, if I'm teaching beginners maybe a weird word, but like basic techniques, then people want like basic recipes to go with them. And I love that your approach is like, we're not doing that. Like, they're basic techniques, but the recipes themselves are not basic at all in terms of flavor or creativity. So there's one that really caught my eye that I'd love for you to talk about, and it's the Bastilla inspired phyllo chicken pie.
So oh yeah.
Tell us about that dish and what the lesson, what the technique lesson is there.
Well, first of all, I really love Bastilla, yeah. But the traditional one, it's like a long braised pigeon, and it's a difficult recipe if you want to make it like fully traditional.
Wrapped in pastry, and it's like,
yeah,
very spiced, and it's Moroccan, right? It's like a beautiful Moroccan pie.
Yeah, and what I love the most about it is it's got like this sweet savory thing happening. Mm. But I wanted to capture the flavor of like a really long braise by just focusing on like the point of this recipe is to teach you how to brown meat, ground meat in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Ground meat can be hard to brown sometimes because it is very wet. And I feel like getting it like really crispy brown, sometimes you end up drying out the meat.
That's totally true. Like, yeah, I had never thought of that, but thinking like searing a steak or a pork chop, as long as the pan is hot and you've dried the surface of the meat, like, it's usually going to work. But yeah, often when you're browning ground meat, like, it releases a lot more juice.
Yeah. So the way I like to brown my ground meat, which I highlight in this recipe, and like in all my like old recipes, I do this as well. I put the ground meat in the pan in like one even layer.
Mm-hmm.
And then just like leave it, because a lot of recipes tell you to like break it up and toss it into crumbles. I just like let it stay put. That's like the main lesson. Just like let it stay put, let it brown. And then it browns really deeply on one side, and then the other side stays a little bit moist. And then you go in and break it up afterwards and add your spices and your garlic and all of that. So the lesson there was just like how to brown meat. But like from that, you get this like really cool recipe that is also a shortcut to Bastilla.
Yeah.
And hopefully it like teaches more people about those flavors, because I think it's like a really cool flavor combo, because in a lot of Western cuisine, you don't use warm spices like cinnamon in savory food as much as you do in like Middle East and South Asia. So it's like a flavor combo that I think you already got cinnamon. So just like now you got more ways to use it.
Yeah. Actually, why don't you walk us through the recipe really quick? So you've browned this ground chicken, and what are the spices you're adding to it?
So it's spiced with garlic, ginger, turmeric, cinnamon, and black pepper.
Mm, okay.
And then what my favorite part is, so you have your little spiced meat mixture. You put it in phyllo, fold it up. After you bake it, you sprinkle it with powdered sugar.
Mm.
And it sounds wild, but the sweet savory thing is really, it's really delicious.
It's crispy, the buttery phyllo, it's crispy. There are raisins in it too, right?
There's raisins, yeah, little pops of sweet, yeah.
Oh, that sounds so good. Right on. Well, thanks so much for coming by, and congratulations on this monumental book.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sola El Whaley is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Start Here, Instructions for Becoming a Better Cook. And she left us with her recipe for that Bastilla-inspired phyllo chicken pie. Find it at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. Go make something new this week, will you? Talk to you in a few. APM Studios are run by Tondra Cavati and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. And it's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer, Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.